So this is the third and final part in our Bechol Dovado, each and every generation, looking at the history and the development of the Haggadah. And for the past couple of weeks, we've been combing through, we've been mining kind of the Mishnayot and the Gemara and the Pesukim in the Torah and Tanakh themselves to try and understand and piece together how the Haggadah came to be. By the end of last week, we had a Haggadah that looks similar enough to ours. Ignore all the songs at the end, which come much later, and a few other quirks and a few other things, some of which we'll talk about today. Another key aspect I'm talking about at the Shabbat Haggadah Drasha, the Arba Banim, the four sons. But otherwise, after last week, we pretty much have the Haggadah before us. But what I want to do today is look at two case studies, and one of which shows how the Haggadah really contributes to a major part of Jewish philosophy. And we'll kind of talk a bit at the end about how this is actually really controversial. Nowadays, this is actually a really controversial part of Jewish philosophy, but nonetheless. And also how we ourselves have shaped the interpretation of one of the major traditions of the Haggadah, moving it completely away of when it first originated into something else. Both of these aren't my ideas. I put at the bottom of the source sheets where they actually come from, the articles that they actually come from, and you can Google and find them online easily enough, and they're, you know, slightly more detailed and slightly more boringly written with a lot more footnotes, but it's still worth checking out. And the first case study to look at how the Haggadah shaped a major aspect of Jewish history, major aspect of Jewish philosophy, begins by realizing it's really a classic question. It's a cliche. Every single Haggadah commentary that exists addresses this. The Haggadah lies. We all know this. We all ask this at our Seder. If you take a look at source number one, it's from Sefer Devarim, from the passage of Arami Oved Avi, which we saw 2 weeks ago. The Mishnah says we have to read Arami Oved Avi and then darshan it. So you're supposed to read the verses, and then, as the Haggadah does, it uses those verses as a springboard for broader ideas about Seder night, about Yitziat Mitzrayim. And so we read, Vayotzeinu Adonai Mitzrayim biyad chazaka v'zruah netuyah v'mor gadol uv'otot umoftim. And God took us out of Egypt with a strong hand, outstretched arm, great awe, with signs and with wonders. To which the Haggadah comments, Lo al yedei malach, v'lo al yedei seraph. Not through an angel, nor a seraph, which is kind of the Jewish equivalent of a dragon, which we can talk about at the end. V'lo al yedei shaliach, nor through a messenger. Ela HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bichvodo Uvatzma. No, it was God alone with his glory in his presence. That is a downright lie. That idea that God alone brought us out of Egypt with the agent, with no other person, no other thing involved in that redemptive experience, is explicitly contradicted by verses in the Torah themselves. First is verse number 3. Which is from Bamidbar, Vanitzak, El Adonai, Vayishma Kolenu. We cried out to the Lord, and he heard us. Vayishlach Malach. And he sent us an angel. Vayotzienu Mimitzrayim, who freed us from Egypt. Vihinei Anachnu Vekadesh, Irkutze Gvulecha. Bamidbar, Moshe says, we had an angel who was the driving force taking us out of Egypt. And if you take a look at source number 4, right at the beginning of Sefer Shemot, V'ata lecha v'eshlachacha el paro. And the English translation, I will send you to Paro, v'hotziat ami v'ni Yisrael mi'mitzrayim, and you shall free my people from Egypt. So not only does God explicitly tell Moshe, you will be the person that frees it, but that word, v'eshlachacha, someone who is eshlachacha, is a shaliach. It's the same shoresh. We translate it differently, but Moshe is being almost officially designated as the messenger, as the emissary of God. And yet the Haggadah says, nope, that didn't actually happen. It was always by God himself. Interestingly, and this kind of goes back to what we've talked about in the last couple of weeks, after source number 2 in the Haggadah brings a proof verse, which talks about Makat Bechorot, the killing of the firstborns, which does not appear in kind of original versions of the Haggadah. So David Henschke, from whom a lot of this is taken, argues that proof verse is brought to try and restrict the ambitious statement of the Haggadah. We can't say only God did everything, because that explicitly contradicts the verses, so the Haggadah tries to get out of it by saying, well, really, only with Makat Bechorot, but everything else, fine. But that's a later addition. And that's not the clear intent of the Haggadah here. It's to say no one else was involved other than God. Now, as an aside, the Rambam, who's always good for a quotable, the Rambam just flat out ignores it because that's what he does when he doesn't like things. If you take a look at source number 5, which is on the Mishneh Torah, V'im haya haben gadol v'chacham, if the son is wise enough and grown up enough, modia, he's talking about the father here, modia mashe era lanu b'mitzrayim, the son should be informed about what happened to us in Egypt, v'nisim she'na'ase lanu al yidei Moshe Rabbeinu, and the miracles that were performed for us through Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Rambam doesn't even care for this statement of the Haggadah, this insistence that God alone did it, not through a messenger, not through an angel. The Rambam's like, no, Moshe was involved, and we talk about that openly at the Seder. The Rambam's Haggadah is different to ours, but nonetheless, we will read on Seder night in just a week and a half from now, emphatically, this thing. Lo al yedei malach, velo al yedei saraf, velo al yedei shaliach. No one else was involved other than God. And it's a classic question on which every single commentary to the Haggadah has an answer. But there's two questions to ask about this. The first is, where does this idea come from? Is the Haggadah making up this idea? Is this an idea innovated by the Haggadah itself? Or does it come from somewhere else? And the answer is it comes from somewhere else, and the Haggadah is merely popularizing an idea already in existence. And second, why? Why does the Haggadah choose to popularize this idea that God himself alone brought us out of Egypt? And these, you know, what I'll say kind of before we actually look at this is, like a lot of the things we've been doing, they're not necessarily the most shareable ideas for the Seder, because I'm not sure who else at your Seder will appreciate the sources we're about to look at. But nonetheless, something that I love about everything we've been doing until now is kind of getting to the bottom of the real reasons why. Seeing the actual nuts and bolts of the Haggadah is something that's really good. So, to understand where the Haggadah gets this idea that God alone saved us from Egypt, it was not through an angel, not through Moshe, no one else was involved, to get the idea of where this first comes from, you have to take a look at source number 6. Source number 6 is from Sefer Yeshayahu, the book of Isaiah. And it says the following. B'chol tzaratam lo tza umalach panav hoshiyam. In all their troubles, he was troubled. B'chol tzaratam, in all their troubles, lo tza, he too was troubled. Umalach panav hoshiyam, and an angel of his presence delivered them. V'ahavato v'chemlato hu ga'olam, in his love and pity he himself redeemed them. V'aynat leim v'aynaseim kol yimei olam. And he raised them and exalted them all their days of old. Now this verse in and of itself seems to be describing everything we've been talking about until now being the problem with the Haggadah. We're going to be focusing on source number 6 for a while, so don't turn to the page just yet, because we have to reread source 6 again differently in a second. But source number 6 seems to confirm everything we've been saying until now. Someone other than God is directly involved in redemption, which is exactly what source number 2 in the Haggadah is saying. No. How does this source help support the idea that Moshe was not actually involved directly in saving us, that no angels were involved? The answer comes from 3 features of source number 6. 2 of which are features every single verse in Tanakh has, and 1 of which is a feature many verses in Nach and Tanakh as a whole have. And we'll start with that one, which is the Kri Ukativ. If you look on source number 6, you'll see the word law is repeated twice. The first time it's Lamed Aleph, and the second time it's Lamed Vav. The Lamed Aleph is not vocalized, it has no vowels. The Lamed Vav is in square brackets and does actually have vowels. And this is an example of what's called a Kri Ukativ, that we preserve, tradition preserves 2 different ways of reading a verse, particularly with words like this, which are homophones, where you have the same word can be, you know, pronounced. It sounds the same, but spelled differently. So like air and air is an example. We breathe air and there is an heir to the throne. So you can imagine there are many examples where this kind of confusion, where these kinds of things can breed confusion, can breed ambiguity. So the first thing to realize here is that there's 2 different ways this word that says law can be read that has a very different meaning. The second thing, and the Creel Kativ comes from the Masoretic tradition. So kind of this goes back about as far back as it goes. There's a tradition of how to read the words of the Torah. And so when we have homophones or when we have ambiguous words, the Creel Kativ, the written text, preserves one way of writing it, but the tradition preserves the way to actually pronounce it. And often, these things can change the meaning.
So this, it isn't that there were like two copies of the text with different spellings?
So it can be... So yeah, so this is where there is less certainty. It could be there are multiple copies of the text, some of which have one version, some of which have others. Yeah, a lot of it comes into that befuddlement that comes from kind of passing down texts over a period of time, some of which have an oral component to them at a certain point. But yeah, there's ambiguity in what exactly some of these words exactly are. The second feature that every single kind of verse has is the cantillation, the trop. Something, if you can kind of follow the trop, great. If not, it's not necessary. But as Shalom Holtz, who's a professor of YU, once pointed out, if you want to know how to read a verse and get the pacing right, you kind of follow the cantillation marks. And where the cantillation marks call for a pause, you pause. Where it threads two words together, thread two words together. So the cantillation marks also help us kind of pace this verse. To understand exactly what it means, the cantillation marks add interpretation, but they also kind of help us sometimes pronounce exactly how the verse flows. And the third feature is the vowels themselves. The vowel themselves are a tradition, and again, there can be ambiguity in the vowels that go under a word. Why are all these three things important? If you strip away all three of those things, the Creel Kativ, and you only read the verse that's written, which is lo, lamed, aleph, the word that's written, you ignore the cantillation marks, which are pacing how you read this verse, and finally, you ignore the vocalization, the vowels under the word, which we're only going to do for one word, but it's a crucial word, you're left with the following verse that I'm going to read and translate. B'chol tzaratam, in all their troubles, lo tzir umalach, neither a messenger or an angel. Panav Hoshiam, it was his face, his presence that saved them. And the rest of the verse reads as follows. The word tsar, which reads as trouble, which is how we traditionally translate this verse, v'chol tzaratam lo tsar. All the troubles of the Jewish people, lo lamed vav, is possessive. It troubled God too, and therefore he sent an angel. But if you read it differently, b'chol tzaratam, the Jewish people were troubled. Lo now as lamed aleph, as the negative, and tsar not as tsari resh, not as tsar, but as tsir, which is a word that means messenger, emissary, and is used in various piyutim, various poems to describe Moshe. Suddenly you have a very different verse. A verse that is indicating that God himself saved the Jewish people, and not through a messenger or an angel. Now, you may be thinking at that point, okay, but that seems to be very special pleading. Like, if we're stripping away three core features of how to read a biblical verse, we're getting rid of the Creel Kativ, which is like literally one of the most important things. We're getting rid of the cantillation marks, also about as important as you get, and the vocalization, the vowels themselves. It seems very implausible that, okay, it works, but only if you ignore every salient feature of the text itself. So surely it just seems like, you know, grasping at straws. And that would be true if it weren't for source number 7. Source number 7 comes from the Septuagint. So the Septuagint translation... Correct, so that, yeah, exactly, well, that's the way we read it. Though in... Correct. You're right, but we have trained ourselves not to read that verse as it is, but you're right. Yeah, you could just look straight in kind of a scroll of Yeshayahu and figure out what I've just had, but every ounce of tradition inside of you would say, no, that's not how you read it. The Septuagint, the Greek translation of Tanakh, and which is fascinating, it contains additions, subtractions, it contains... interpretations. Megillat Esther is a great example of the Greek translation where it just changes everything. It inserts the name of God, which is famously missing from our version of Esther. It adds tons of narrative to basically make Esther more religious. She davens, she prays. Dragons make an appearance, which is really fun, and the second time we've mentioned dragons today, which is really a poor reflection on all the other shirim that we've not mentioned dragons before, but nonetheless, the Greek translation of everything is often very fascinating. And the Greek translation of Yeshayahu of Isaiah in source number 7 says the following. And he became, and it's kind of, I started with, it kind of splices the verses slightly differently also because of the flow, but and he became to them salvation out of all affliction. It was no ambassador or angel, but the Lord himself that saved them. Because he loved them and spared them, he himself redeemed them, raised them, and exalted them all their days, all the days of old. The Septuagint understands, source number 6, the alternative way. The Septuagint understands, source number 6, Yeshayahu with the Lamed, as though it's reading it straight from a scroll without the Masoretic clues, which are generally not something that's a feature of, in fact, usually kind of the our version. If you're a scholar, our version of Tanakh gets MT in front of it, which is Masoretic text, and the Septuagint gets LXX because it's its own version, so it's almost by definition ignoring kind of the traditional understanding of Tanakh. But the point is that if you are looking for evidence that at least some Jews understood a verse in Tanakh to be portraying what the Haggadah declares, Lo al yidei malach, lo al yidei tsaraf, lo al yidei shaliach, only God himself saved us, neither through a messenger nor an angel, then you find it in the Septuagint translation of Yeshayahu, and we can therefore assume other people read the verse this way also. So now we know where the Haggadah gets it from, but that only really solves half the problem, because why does the Haggadah take what is kind of a minority way to understand a verse? And again, we have all these other verses in the Torah which seem to indicate otherwise, which seem to indicate the clear angelic intervention and Moshe's action in saving us. Why does the Haggadah popularize this minority verse, this minority understanding of a verse in Tanakh? What's driving it to push for this understanding of the Pesach story? So David Henschke, from whom this is from, and again, the full title of his article is at the bottom of the first page, begins answering by noting a few other really weird features of the Haggadah. So until this point, again, by the end of last week, we had filled in most of our Haggadah, but there were a couple of things we had left unexplored, and we kind of turn to all of them now. All of these things, sources 8, 9, and 10, are ripped straight from the Haggadah. They basically flow from one another, and straight afterwards is kind of the verses of which sources 1 and 2 also follow from. The first thing we read in the Haggadah is source 8. Baruch Shomer Havtachato Yisrael. Blessed is the one who kept his promise to Israel. Baruch Hu, blessed is he. Shehakadosh Baruch Hu Chishev et Haketz. For God calculated the end. La'asot k'moshin she'amah la'Avraham Avinu b'vrit bein habatarim. Just as he'd spoken to Avraham in the Brit bein habatarim, the covenant between the pieces, one of the most famous mathematical problems in the Torah. God says your children will be slaves in the land for X amount of time, and yet they're only slaves in Egypt for Y amount of time, and this creates a problem, and everyone tries to figure it out. And kind of the Haggadah starts raising this issue at this point, that no, everyone else's calculations are wrong. But kind of God knew how to calculate things perfectly. He knew exactly how to figure out when the right time to redeem the Jewish people. Only God himself knows that perfect moment in time to redeem people. That's the first thing we declare. So it kind of fits with the Haggadah, but not really. It's a bit of a non sequitur. It just kind of comes out of nowhere. It doesn't really fit with anything else we've been reading in the Haggadah until this point. That's the first strange feature. The second strange feature is the passage that we all love to sing, and it has many lovely tunes. V'hisha amda la'avotenu v'lanu, It's a promise that is stood by our ancestors and us. Shelo echad bilvad amad aleinu l'chalotenu, for it's not just one man who rose to destroy us. Ela shebechol dovado omdim aleinu l'chalotenu. Each and every single generation people rise up to destroy us. V'hakadosh baruch hu matzileinu miadam, and God saves us from their hands. It's a beautiful, very powerful statement. But you're left wondering, of all the nights to be declaring this, Seder night seems a weird night to be doing so. On Seder night, we are supposed to be thanking God for taking us out of Egypt. That's what we're doing. That's exactly the motivation for the Seder. And all of a sudden we turn around and are like, on the one hand it's good, we expand kind of God's role, but we also kind of diminish the significance of Yitziat Mitzrayim, of the Exodus, because it's like, you know, actually, it happens every generation, doesn't it? And you can imagine at the Seder at this point, if someone were to raise it, you'd be like, you're kind of missing the point here. We're focusing right now on Egypt. Let's focus on other stuff another time. But right now, we're just focusing on this. And yet, Vehisha Amda's like, no. This happens every generation, almost as though it's asking, why is Seder night so special? And it gets worse. If you take a look at source number 10. So before we get to source number 10, actually, we read a couple of Mishnah at this point. The Mishnah instructs us, Doresh me Arami Oved Avi. Read from the portion in the Torah in Sefer Devarim, Arami Oved Avi. It's five verses. When Jews would bring their Bikurim, their first fruits, to the Beit HaMikdash, they would read a passage which summarizes the story of Egypt. And we read four of those verses in the Haggadah, because the final one talks about bringing stuff to the Beit HaMikdash, and in a time when there's no Beit HaMikdash, no temple, we don't read that verse anymore. But the word Arami, or the phrase Arami Oved Avi, is kind of ambiguous. And I am no biblical grammarian, but basically it's unclear what the subject and object of the word Oved is. There's two ways you can read the verse, the words Arami Oved Avi. One is, Arami Oved was my father, my father. The second way to read it is Arami, and Arami was Oved Avi. Those are the two ways, and we'll translate them both ways. But basically, because you don't know what is Oved, the way basically every single major kind of commentator who has grammatical chops translates the verse in Sefer Devarim, an Arami Oved was Avi. A wandering Aramean was my father. And that makes a lot of sense. Because what you're doing is you're trying to explain how did the Jewish people end up in Egypt. And basically think of the story of how the Jewish people, you know, end up in Egypt. There's a famine in the land. And Yaakov, and indeed Yitzchak and Abraham, are somewhat nomadic. They move around as they see fit. Yaakov was an Arami Oved. He was a wandering Aramean. And so when there was a famine, he moved down to Egypt. It made sense. He was nomadic. That's how we begin by explaining how did we end up in Egypt, due to the nomadic nature of our Avi, of Yaakov. The other way to translate it is an Arami was Oved Avi. An Aramean sought to destroy my father. To which, and this is the way the Haggadah translates it. Look at source number 10. Say ulamad, ma vi kesh Lavan harami la'asot li Yaakov avinu. Go and learn what Lavan sought to do to Yaakov. Sheparo lo gazar el al hazcharim. Lavan sought to uproot, Paro condemned only the boys to death. Ve'Lavan vi kesh la'akor et hakot. Lavan sought to destroy everything. Shneema, as it says, Arami Oved Avi, an Aramean sought to destroy my father. And thus Yaakov fled to Egypt. The first problem with translating it that way is that's not the story. Like, think of the story of Sefer Bereshit. Yaakov is not prompted by Lavan's frustrations with him. Even if we see Lavan as kind of the arch enemy of Yaakov, Lavan is dispensed with long before anything major is on the scene when it comes to leaving to Egypt. Yaakov, unless there's parts of the story we don't know about, Lavan is not the motivation for Yaakov going on to. It makes no sense. This is why everyone understands the verse in Sefer Devarim as, my father was a wandering Aramean, because that makes sense. He was a nomad, and therefore he fled the land to avoid famine. This way makes no sense. But again, if you translate it the way the Haggadah is doing, again, think of how that reflects on the Seder night. Once again, the Haggadah, on the night we are celebrating God saving us from Paro's hands, the Haggadah's like, guys, have you thought about it for a second? There's actually someone worse than Paro. Because at the end of the day, all Paro wanted to do was kill the boys. That wasn't so bad. There are people who are worse. Think of Lavan. He wanted to kill everyone. Who does that at the Seder? Who? There are many other times of the year. Any other time of the year might make sense to talk about the other horrors the Jewish people have faced in history and God's, you know, redeeming us from them. It would make sense on Yom HaShoah. It would make sense on many, on Tisha B'Av. Many other times it would make sense to reflect on all the other horrific people in our, you know, that have affected our history, who have sought to destroy us, and maybe reflect on the grand scheme of things, Paro ain't that bad. But it seems a really weird thing to do at the Seder. Paro, the guy who enslaved us, who we have a whole festival to celebrate God's redemption, you know, from, we're now minimizing? It makes absolutely no sense to be declaring on Seder night, worse things have happened. You know what? We really should be focusing on Lavan right now, guys. You know, it sounds like that annoying kind of person who's just come back from some sort of, you know, learning experience who's like, hold on a second. Let's actually focus on something else entirely. It doesn't make any sense. Why does the Haggadah insist, just before we expound on the Arami Oved Avi passage, on talking about God's ability to calculate times perfectly and start diminishing the uniqueness and the special nature of Yitziat Mitzrayim? So, David Henschka argues something fascinating. By expanding the role of Yitziat Mitzrayim from being a singular event, from being this was the one time God did something magical, to saying this happens to all of us. This is the template for salvation. That's what the Haggadah is declaring. No. Seder night isn't the one time we celebrate God taking us out from Egypt. It's the template. All the other times God will save us. Shebechol dovado omdim aleinu v'akadosh baruch hu matzilenu meyadam, as we say in Vehisha Amda. This is the template. Every time God saves us, this is what's going to happen. And at the same time, the Haggadah is emphasizing the fact that God alone saved us. No one else, lo al yidei malach, lo al yidei saraf, lo al yidei shleich, no one else was involved in saving us whatsoever other than God. God alone saves us. God alone knows the perfect time to redeem us. And he alone knows it and no one else does, because you try to calculate those numbers in the Torah and they make no sense. The only one who understands them is God. Only he alone knows the time of redemption. And he does it for everything. Worst people have happened, Lavan has happened, every generation people try to destroy us. God will always save us in the same way by himself. And David Henschka argues, and he conjectures at this point, because it's unclear exactly when this part of the Haggadah developed, but what we know about this period of time in which the Haggadah developed was messianic movements were rife. You have, for instance, the Bar Kokhba revolt against the Romans. You know, at one point in Jewish history around this time, you have lots of, I mentioned last week, how that it's a hard argument to make that the Haggadah is an opposition to Christianity. But Christianity was but one of kind of the messianic movements floating around in this period of time. There were a lot of messianic pretenders. There were a lot of people clamoring for human intervention in driving away oppressors from the Jewish people. And what David Henschka argues, or at least suggests, is that the Haggadah is directly opposed to this. And the reason the Haggadah elevates and popularizes what is otherwise an outlandish idea that goes completely against the verses in the Torah, that God himself redeemed us and redeemed us alone, is to argue against those people sat around their Sedarim at that time who think otherwise. Only God himself will know the time to redeem us. It's not in anyone else's hands. Pesach is always the template for everyone else, because that's why the Haggadah expands its role. This isn't a unique event. This happens in every generation. in the generation that the Haggadah, this is being included in the Haggadah. That's the point. People are clamoring for redemption, and the Haggadah is saying, this is going to happen in exactly the same way, only through God and through no one else. And this is a statement of the Haggadah that really shapes a major aspect of Jewish philosophy. For a large period of time, the idea that Jews themselves not take it into their own hands to seek redemption was very much, and to some extent is still today, a major argument proffered by people. However, as David Henschke himself notes, and I said at the beginning, nowadays this is a deeply controversial idea because of the state of Israel. And because for religious Zionists, the human action in building the land of Israel just yesterday, everyone, you know, voting in Israel who feels like they are taking part in some sense in the redemptive process seems to fly in the face of everything the Haggadah is arguing. So David Henschke has a fascinating footnote where he points out how religious Zionist thinkers, chief among them Rav Kook, had to start reading parts of the Haggadah to articulate a human-led messianic era. So, for instance, the story of the sages in Bnei Barak is often nowadays you'll hear people talking about the tradition that it's actually talking about the Bar Kokhba revolt. And part of the reason is because now suddenly we are talking about people using the story of the Seder to fuel their human-led act of redemption. So we read into, we interpret into another part of the Haggadah a story, an idea that advocates for human intervention. But when these passages were being included into the Haggadah, the complete opposite was being intended.
Did they read the story of Bar Kokhba in there positively or negatively?
The rabbis, positively. These rabbis are playing the Bar Kokhba revolt, which was a good thing.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good thing. So Rav Kook is one of the people who... Rav Kook reads the story of the sages in Bnei Barak, as this is all taking place during the Bar Kokhba revolt, and they are inspired by the story of the Seder.
And all the messianic movements were okay?
I don't follow, sorry.
Rav Kook takes a stand that the messianic movements
were... No, but the religious Zionism, which is a messianic movement, justifying...
All the other ones are bad, but this one...
Yeah. He's not legitimizing any other messianic movement... But religious Zionism is unquestionably, at least in the Rav Kookian sense, again, there's many stripes to religious Zionism, but in the Rav Kookian sense, religious Zionism is one of two very famous 20th, 21st century messianic movements in Judaism.
But he also, a core of his theology is looking at things that seem to be human and interpreting them to be divine.
Yeah.
So the fact that the state was founded by largely secular atheists, you interpret that, no, it's the hand of God working through these people.
Yeah, but that's exactly the point. Al Yadei Malach, Al Yadei Shaliach. The core belief of Rav Kook is God works Al Yadei Shaliach, which is explicitly not the view of the Haggadah. So what we have here, which is fascinating, was the Haggadah out of nowhere and for a justifiable reason comes up with this idea or popularizes this idea that God does not work through any human intervention whatsoever. That doesn't kind of make sense, but the point is, it's really wanting to insist on this. Fast forward to the, 19th century, 20th century, when people do want to use the Seder as articulating for human-led redemption, for God working Al Yadei Shaliach. So you can't work with these passages because they don't help. You have to find something else to see because we would otherwise read Yetziyah, if we didn't have the Haggadah saying all of this stuff, Yetziyah Mitzrayim is a perfect example of someone got up and did something. Moshe Rabbeinu, God works through human hands. That would lend itself if the Haggadah didn't explicitly say otherwise. So Rav Kook takes another story we read, which as we mentioned last week, a couple of reasons why we read the story of the sages in Bnei Barak is simply to kind of just legitimize the entire project of the Seder night. But if you read it as these rabbis are plotting or a part of the Bar Kokhba rebellion and they are being inspired by the story of Yetziyat Mitzrayim, the story of Yetziyat Mitzrayim once again becomes, Seder night once again becomes an inspirational story for people to use to justify human-led, you know, messianic attempts, human-led redemptions. But what's fascinating is that this idea that's so core, and again, it's harder to appreciate nowadays because in the 21st century, especially in kind of the modern Orthodox religious Zionist world, we are so ardently in favor of the idea of, even if we're not going to articulate a strong messianism like Rav Kook, we are very fond of the idea of human-led redemption. But nonetheless, for most of Jewish history, the quietism was, you know, a more dominant strain, and it really comes, a major force of that view comes from the Haggadah, comes from the alternative way to read Sefer Yeshayahu, and that really, and it fuels such a major part of Jewish philosophy. And I think, personally, that's a really fascinating thing for the Haggadah to contribute out of nowhere, in order to insist against human-led redemption, that still the impact of which is felt to this day in Jewish philosophy. I now want to turn to the second case study, which is the other way around, how we have changed the entire meaning of one of Pesach's most famous rituals, the dipping, spilling out a bit of blood as we recite the 10 plagues, and as we recite the Tzach Adash Biachav, as we recite the 10 plagues, we spill out a drop of wine. Now, the famous reason offered for this, and we can look already at sources 15 and 16, I took both, you know, the archetypal modern Orthodox Haggadah and the archetypal, you know, Haredi kind of English Haggadah in art school, and look at sources 15 and 16. In explaining the spilling out, Lord Satz writes, many explanations have been offered. The most beautiful is that of Avudraham, who interprets it in accordance with the verse in Proverbs, do not rejoice when your enemy falls, even as we give thanks for the miracle of the plagues, as a result of which our ancestors gained their freedom, we also shed a symbolic tear for those who suffered. And the art scroll, and you'll have noticed for sources 15 and 16, I copied the fonts these two texts appear in, because that's the kind of weird person I am. But in source number 16, art score right, Abarbanel, however, explains that we should remove the wine because, quote, you should not rejoice when your enemy falls. Now, this idea, we're going to unpack for a bit. First of all, this idea is known in other contexts. The idea that we reduce halal. One of the famous ideas, there are times in which we say full halal, and there are times in which where we skip some parts of halal, and one of the major ideas sometimes for skipping parts of halal on the latter days of Pesach is because the Egyptians died. There was suffering that took place. That is an idea already found within the Gemara. That doesn't extrapolate well to Seder night, because we read full halal on Seder night. We don't invoke that idea on Seder night itself. And in fact, as we're going to start looking at now, the actual reasons offered historically for why we dip blood out could not be more different. And it begins with the Rocher Rav Elazar of Worms. I can't remember exactly when he lived, but medieval times. And he says the following, and this source is kind of an everything in the kitchen sink approach, but anyway, he says the following about the custom. Al kol teva etzbayadam bekos hayayin umetipat lachutz. For each word of the 10 plagues, a finger goes in the cup of wine and they spill out a drop. Keneged charvo shel hakadosh baruch hu, yud vav panim, matching the sword of the Holy One, blessed be he, which has 16 sides. Again, if you count out all the times, you have the 10 plagues, you have dam vo'esh v'timrot ashan, and you have the tzach adash v'yachav, you get 16 drips all in all. So the first reason is because God wields a sword that has 16 sides. Don't know exactly what that would look like, sounds cool, but there you go. V'yodvav pa'amim diber b'yirmiyahu. And 16 times Yirmiyahu speaks of a plague. Lomar lanu lo yazik, teaching us that we will not be injured. Mikan samchu avotenu. Because of this, our forefathers created this custom. V'yodvav chayim achayeh betamnyana api. 16 times the word chayim, life, appears in one of the Psalms. Yudvav anashim korin v'shavua l'torah keneged yudvav kevasim hamakrivim b'shavua. 16 times during the week, men are called for aliyot to the Torah to correspond to the 16 lambs that were sacrificed in a week in the Beit HaMikdash. Zehu eitz chayim hila machazikim ba. The famous verse, she is like tree of life for those who grasp her, referring to Torah. The word he has gematria, the numbers the letters correspond to, gets you 16. Ve'ein lehit lotzetz al minhag avotenu hakadoshim. And one must not ridicule the custom of our holy ancestors. So the first thing, source number 11, not quite clear what the reason is. He's coming up with every possible reason. Also, whenever someone says, don't ridicule the custom of the ancestors, you know what that means. People are ridiculing the custom of the ancestors. And his best attempt is to come up with, it would have been nice if he would have come up with 60 different reasons. But he comes up with a lot of different reasons. Some of which are maybe complementary, but we have God's sword, we have the protective element, it means life, people are called to Aliyah, which corresponds to the sacrifices. The point is, every possible reason to justify the dipping 16 comes in. One of which is, you know, so first of all, the entire significance of the dipping here is in its number alone. That's the sole significance suggested by the Rokech. Nothing at this stage explicit to do with anything else other than the sympathetic magic aspect to it, which is by dipping 16 times, something is happening somewhere, and it's theurgic, it's somehow compelling God to do stuff for us. I didn't do the math, but
probably
he says...
Not
yeah. Yeah, so there you go. I just didn't even bother writing them back, because I'm just like, I'll take your word for it, it's not even worth it. Source number 12, the Darchei Moshe, the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the defining halachist of Ashkenazi Jewry, has a commentary to the Torah, which is kind of the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch, where the Ramah is drawn, his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch is drawn from, it's his more expansive commentary, and he writes the following. V'nire, sherumzim kan shecharvo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it seems that this dipping is an allusion to the sword of God. Nikra Yohach, that is called Yohach. We get more, it's cool. Vahu Malach Memoneh al Hanikma Kiyadua Lemukablim. It's the angel responsible for vengeance, as known to the Kabbalists. Vinohagin Lizrok min Hakos Be'etzba Lirumaz al Mashne Ema Etzba Elohim Hu. And therefore we dip with our finger to allude to what we also say at the Seder, which is it's the finger of God. That declaration is God is weaving miracles, the necromancers of Paros say, this is a sign that it's the finger of God. That's why we use our finger. And so the symbolism now comes up more. The sword of God is a sword of vengeance. And we are kind of using God's finger to direct his vengeance against those who want to seek, you know, those who want to hurt us. My grandfather, he still does, but I've not had Seder with him for a few years. I just remember one of my enduring memories is as we're doing the dippings, and he would always spill out a few more afterwards, and he'd be like, and a few for Arafat too. And we were always like, whoa, that's not the reason why. It turns out it is the reason why, and we were all wrong. But anyway, source number 12, it's about vengeance. God, take out vengeance on your enemies. And the 16, again, the sympathetic magic idea of we are kind of calling on the angel of God, which is his sword, to kill everyone. The Mishnah Berurah says, and now we're fast forwarding to the 19th-20th century here, the Mishnah Berurah says, why do we spell it out? Keneged otiyot yod vav mishmo shel hakadosh baruch hu shehika et paro. Because God has yod and vav in his name. And so the 16, and it's actually funny because you all have seen in all of these texts, they write yod vav. They don't typically... When we spell out Hebrew numbers, we don't do 15 and 16 as Yud Hey and Yud Vav. We do them as Tet Vav and Tet Zion because we don't want to spell out the name of God. But explicitly, the Mishnah Berurah is picking up on the fact that no, the clear connotation here is God's name. God who struck Paro and therefore by extension strikes everyone else. That's again who we're calling on. We're invoking God as we dip 16 times. And finally, source number 14, Rabbi Reuven Margalit in his Haggadah Be'er Miriam, which again is 20th century. Va'od yesh lefarish. So first of all, he quotes the Rokech, and then he says, furthermore, we can explain this custom to dip. Shehu remez ki makot elu, hein ketipot mikos hatrala she'atid HaKadosh Baruch Hu lahashkot kol hamitzirim liYisrael. The plagues are only a small drop from the cup of retribution that God will force our persecutors to drink in the future. So again, the symbolism, we're no longer kind of calling on a sword, but again, the symbolism here, these plagues are, you know, kind of beautiful symbolism because it's perfect. These plagues are but a drop in the cup of pain and vengeance God will force our enemies to drink. For even going into the 20th century, the view of the spilling of the cups was vengeance, was in some way or another calling on God to kill everyone who hates us. And then, within a very short space of time, we have the Artscroll and Lord Sacks, and it is basically every Haggadah ever written since, and Sviron, I think he points to the exact date, but basically every Haggadah ever written since a point in the 1920s starts doing this. No, it's because we're sad. These are tears, and we are spilling out of our cups because our cups aren't full because people suffer. Now, this
article is...
So this is where things get really cool. So I didn't bother with all of this because you can read it in the article, and I encourage you to read it in the article. The Abarbanel never says this. There is no Abarbanel ever. Abarbanel, one of the major medieval commentators, never once does he say this. So Sviron argues, he traces down the first person to originate this idea, which comes from the 19th, 20th century. And he points out that it was not a well-known rabbi, but he gets quoted in a sefer. And so when you see kind of his initials in that book, you automatically assume those are the initials of the Abarbanel. Just as, our son is, our baby boy is called Shai. Shmuel Yitzchak, it's Shin Chukchik Yud. And as someone pointed out, if he ever became a rabbi, he'd be Rashi. So one day someone could quote Shai one day and write in a sefer and just write his acronym as Rashi. And then all of a sudden someone like 10 years later, unbeknownst, knowing exactly who Shai is, could read it and be like, and not even think, just be like, Rashi says this. Remember, it's very hard to actually trace what everyone says, and that's not a crazy thing. There are lots of rabbis who share initials. There are lots of rabbis who share the names of books. Because traditionally rabbis like to name their books after verses in the Torah, or verses in Tanakh. And so for instance, if I were to ever to write a Hebrew book, my Hebrew name is Mordechai, I would call it something like Techelet Mordechai from Megillat Esther, you know, the Techelet of Mordechai, the glory of Mordechai. There are if you try and search and find Techelet Mordechai, there are a bajillion Techelet Mordechai. So it's often very hard. You'd be surprised at how many of the Safnat Paneach, which is one of the alternative names of Yosef. There's more than one of them, and they're very different people. So, you know, it's not uncommon for people, and I have made that very same mistake with the Safnat Paneach, of you read something outlandish, and you're like, whoa, he said this, and then you find out, no, it's a different guy, who's less impressive. But the point is that the Avudraham, I said above nothing earlier, but the Avudraham, oh, interestingly. That could have been a typo from me, but that would also lend itself to the idea that Avudraham and Abarbanel are both kinds of people who, again, you can imagine their initials confusing people.
If you're going to have a typo, great to have it with the art scroll, but considering it's full of typos.
That's a good point. Yeah. But basically, he points out that this was. If we think of what we spoke about the first half, the first case, we have a minority idea elevated because the Haggadah has a point it wants to make. And it shapes Jewish philosophy because of it. So Sviron argues we have this very obscure guy proffering this idea, but you know what? We really like it. We like it for a bunch of reasons. The first major one is the idea of a vengeance Seder doesn't lend itself to 20th, 21st century American and, you know, Jewry as a whole. We don't like the idea of sending God out. You know, a lot of people at least wince uncomfortably at Shafoch Chamatcha as we open our doors. We're like, kill them all. Kill everyone of our war. Like, shall we really be saying this tonight? But, you know, there's a general discomfort with the idea of like, God, just murder everyone. We call upon your angelic sword to go strike our enemies. It just seems a bit weird. Second and more significantly, the whole idea of this ritual of specifically 16 times, and we are somehow through those 16 drops invoking an angelic, you know, strike on our enemies, that just doesn't gel well. The idea that most people in the 20th century are tuned in enough to be counting and to realize that what we're doing is sympathetic magic, putting aside the problems with sympathetic magic, which is a whole other topic for another time, but people don't, I mean, people do sympathetic magic far too much in the Jewish world these days, but people don't intuitively grasp it. And even, you know, and you can see kind of that even in kind of the Haggadat Be'er Miriam, where he changes the idea to fit more with the symbolism. It's not because he doesn't know of the idea of the sword, it's because he realizes this va'od yesh lefarish, that sword idea just doesn't work with people. The idea that we're all aware of how many sides God has of his sword, it's just not something we know. And so he changes it to something of direct symbolism. It's just a small drop in the cup of, you know, pain and suffering God will force our enemies to drink. But again, you see, just the idea just wouldn't have traction with 20th century and 21st century Jewry. This entire idea. And thus, we as 20th, 21st century Jewry completely changed a ritual in the Haggadah. Its entire original intent was, and again, the whole idea of, you know, diminishing our joy because of the suffering of others is a Jewish idea. It's just not an idea on Seder night because we say the whole of Hallel. If there's one night of the year where you don't lessen your joy because of the suffering of others, it's Seder night. And yet, because we like this idea, it appeals to us, it works, it's a better explanation for 1,000 reasons than all the other traditional explanations, we have completely changed the idea. So much so that Lord Sacks at least acknowledges many, one second, at least Lord Sacks at least acknowledges many explanations have been offered, but doesn't say what they are, and just offers the most beautiful. But most of the Haggadot just give this idea. You know, we could probably do an experiment. How many people at their Seder will hear, you know, will be reinforced this idea that we're spilling because of the sadness? It's just not, it is a thing, because it's a beautiful idea someone came up with in the 20th century. But aside from that, no, the Avudraham is not the guy. It's some, I forget, and again, Sriron talks about it. It's a rabbi who was quoted. So he traces the actual person, but it's some guy. The name didn't resonate with me. But when his name was recorded in a sefer in Hebrew, people think, and again, no one actually checks sources. Whenever you see it, the classic line is whenever someone quotes a source, always look it up and you'll be surprised what you'll find. It's very frustrating when you're, say, a Shir writer, and you're like, oh, this is a great source, and you look and you're like, I cannot find this anywhere. But, you know, that people made that, people just assume, because no one's going to go trawling through all of the Avudraham or Abarbanel, whichever one it is, no one's going to go through and find that.
Take it at face value,
and it's a nice explanation.
Because it's misquoted by people that you trust.
Exactly. It's a mistake. Yeah. It's misquoted by every single Haggadah. Somewhere in the 1920s, I think it says 1927 is where the proliferation first starts to appear. But the major point is that we completely changed the meaning of a core ritual of the Haggadah because we didn't like the actual reason, or it just didn't work for us. And so it is so cool to realize that even in the 20th, 21st century, the Haggadah has been changing. So, I mean, so the Haggadah might, for its own reasons, list the 10 plagues, because that kind of makes sense. Why does this custom develop? So the earliest recording of the custom is Rabbi Elazar of Worms, who's offering a bajillion reasons trying to justify it, which also does kind of point to the fact he's not quite sure which one it is. But at least by the times of the Ramah, it's known that it's a vengeance custom. But we've changed it, and that's what's so cool, because, you know, very on the...
But you could even just look, I don't know if there are more sources than what you have.
There's a bajillion more.
Based on these sources, this narrative is that the interpretation that it's about vengeance is just as much of a chiddush as it's about pouring out sadness. Because Rebbe Elazar of Worms doesn't say anything about vengeance.
So
it's later on that it comes in.
We're taking whatever...
So he mentions it's Keneged Charvo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's corresponding to his sword.
Okay.
And the Ramah explains what he's meaning.
Yeah.
I don't think he's not, and as he says, you know, Kiyadur Lemekubalim, so he's like, I'm not really sure what I'm getting into here, but like everyone, so I would assume Rav Elazar of Worms, when he says the sword of God, he knows what that means. And that is this, you know, this six, I mean, why else does God have a 16-sided sword? It's not ceremonial. Right. It's stabbing people with it.
Right.
Okay. The idea that it's actually an angel, fine, that may be, you know, but the idea is God is using his sword to kill the people, you know, who are trying to kill us. So that idea is already found, but it gets developed and tweaked. But then it just gets completely abandoned in favor of the idea we all offer nowadays. And it shows how, as we've seen kind of at the beginning in the Torah, we had just Pesach, Matzah, Maror, the communal setting and the education. And slowly through the period of Bayit Sheni, more customs came to be part of the Seder. The Mishnah started to codify it. The Gemara, seeking to explain what the Mishnah was saying, brought more and more shape to the Haggadah. But even in the 20th and 21st century, you know, things have been changing. Again, a lot of the songs are kind of medieval folk songs. But, you know, we see even in the 20th, 21st century, the Haggadah is live in ways that other parts of, you know, Jewish life are not. In that even if we're not changing the actual text anymore, the way we interpret the text, the way we understand the text, completely changes how we understand the Haggadah from how the Haggadah was understood in the past. And so it kind of rounds out how the history of the Haggadah, how b'chol dor v'dor, in each and every generation, as we've been obligated to understand our Yetziat Mitzrayim, we've been obligated to re-experience Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt, we have also in each and every generation contributed something to the Haggadah, whether in times gone by that was actual text, or nowadays interpretation that overwhelms all other understandings. The Haggadah, more than anything else, has been developed and, you know, increased and added to throughout Jewish history.